Okay, welcome everybody. This is the seventh lecture in the Mises Academy class, Mises on Money and Banking. It's March 14th, 2012, and tonight's topic is banking and fiduciary media. So as you're watching the slideshow presentation, you can see from this outline, we've got a lot of interesting topics to cover tonight. And for those who are seeing the video as well as hearing the audio, let me explain that I am doing this from a hotel room. That's why I'm not in my usual dapper attire, and I hope the connection holds up for us. So at the very least, you should probably be able to at least hear me. Okay, so let's go ahead and get started. Let me before we jump right into this, let me just back up and make sure you're seeing the big picture. We spent a lot of time going through basically Mises talking about money and monetary theory, the first six lectures pretty much. And then now in this one, we're going to focus on banking and fiduciary media. Technically, we've already talked about fiduciary media because it is related to Mises' definitions of money, right? The fiduciary media are part of money in the broader sense, as he calls it. So we've already touched on this. But so here we're really going to focus on banking and the connection between banking and fiduciary media. And then finally, we're going to be in a position so that next week, week eight of the course, we can at long last go through, and we already have the tools now to talk about what Mises would call the circulation credit theory of the trade cycle, or nowadays we would just call the Austrian theory of the business cycle. Maybe one last clarification. The book, The Theory of Money and Credit, is not organized with those same proportions, right? So it's not that in the book, 6/8 of it are devoted to money, and then at the end it's just, but rather when I was going through this to try to figure out how can we condense all the stuff in this book into an 8-week course that people who, you know, like the Mises Academy would be interested in, I decided the two things we really have to get out of this course are, first of all, that you understand the regression theorem, and secondly, that you understand a necessity and business cycle theory, at least as he understood it when he wrote The Theory of Money and Credit. And so that's how I picked the lectures, and that's, you know, how it affected the pacing. And so that's why we ended up where the last week of the course is going to be what's chapter 19 in the book. Right, so there's a lot more stuff in The Theory of Money and Credit than what we're covering in this course. So just make sure you understand that. Okay, so first main slide here, two branches of banking. The first one, Mises says that, well, first of all, let's be clear, what is banking? And Mises says that banking, strictly speaking, is the practice, I'm paraphrasing, is the practice of lending other people's money. And he said, if you're lending your own money, you're not a banker. That makes you a capitalist. Okay, so that's what Mises means by the term banker or banking. It's that somebody whose economic function it is to get money from some group of people over here, the savers, and then give it to people over here. Or more specifically, once you realize the nature of fiduciary media, it's lending money that isn't yours, or lending money that you don't own and that you personally didn't save. So that's what banking is, because again, if you're lending money that you personally saved, that, you know, you would have the right to consume it, it's yours, but instead you abstain from consumption and then you lend it to somebody else in exchange for, you hope, getting more money back in the future, you're still lending and you're still granting credit to that person, but you're not a banker. You're a capitalist. Okay, so anyway, back to this first slide. Two branches of banking. The first branch that Mises talks about is negotiating credit through the loan of other people's money, which is incidentally what Rothbard refers to as loan banking. And the second branch is lending out fiduciary media. And Rothbard calls that deposit banking. Okay. Let me clarify something also on this, because it might be confusing some of you. Typically, when I talk to an Austrian crowd and I talk about banking, I usually say there's different functions that banks serve, and I kind of break it up into two main ones. And I say they can be a warehouse for your money, and they can be a credit intermediary. And so notice those don't map quite up with what Mises is doing here. Okay, so in other words, Mises is not here, how can I put it? Mises is saying the main function of banking per se is to lend money to people that you're getting from somewhere else, that's not your own as a banker. Mises, so he's not saying that one of the main functions of banking is to act as a warehouse for your money, as a storage place, as a safekeeping place. That it's not the security aspect of it, it's the credit intermediary function. And then Mises is saying, given that that's the purpose of banking, or that's the essence of banking, there's two branches of that. Okay, so again, I'm probably confusing you if you never heard me talk about that before, but I just want to be clear in case you've had me talk, you know, if you took my class in the Fed or other things I may have done. I know that that's kind of the way I introduce it to people, because I want people to split up in their mind a checking account from a savings account, since with modern fractional reserve banking, all of these functions of banking kind of get merged into one thing. And that's what leads people to say stuff like, well, gee, if we didn't have fractional reserve banking, you know, how could checking accounts exist? You know, if the bank isn't allowed to lend out my deposits and earn interest on it, then how could I have a checking account? That would be impossible. The bank wouldn't make any money. You know, so there's issues like that. So that's why I like to, you know, theoretically distinguish those two things. And you could say, no, if the bank, you know, in its capacity of acting as a storage house, as a place where you're going to put all your gold coins because you're afraid that a thief's going to break into your house, or as a place because of matters of convenience where, you know, you have to go into town and engage in a lot of big transactions with various merchants, and you don't want to have to hire a cart to carry around, you know, 17 pounds worth of, or 1,700 pounds worth of gold, and hire a bunch of, you know, armed men to guard it while you're walking around town too. It's easier to put all that gold on deposit in the bank, and then you're walking around with a checkbook. Okay, so and then if it's 100% reserve banking, and that's just your demand deposit, why would the bank do that? Well, you'd have to pay them somehow. Like, you know, there'd be various methods of doing it, that maybe they would charge you a flat amount per year, or maybe they would charge you an amount based in proportion to your average balance, or who knows what. But the point is, that would be a service to you. Just like a college kid who goes home during the summer and doesn't, you know, hasn't moved his stuff into where he's going to live in the following school year, rents out a storage facility and keeps his couch and his, you know, lights that he grows marijuana with and whatever in the storage facility and locks it up, and he pays somebody a fee for that. So the same token, you could hire and pay a fee to some company that has a big safe place where you keep your gold, all right? And it just so happened that historically the institution or the people that happened to be doing that also were the ones that were acting as credit intermediaries. So people who had money they wanted to save and invest it in something very safe to get a, you know, a small rate of return, would go and give it to these people, and they would go lend it out to people who needed a mortgage or whatever. So that's why when I say to a general crowd that I'm talking to about banking for the first time, I usually split it up and say there's two things that banks do in our modern world, and that's the way I talk about it. So notice, though, that it's kind of similar to what Mises is doing here, but I just want to be clear. Mises is saying, no, banking is the lending of money that's not yours. And then so when he splits it up into two, he's saying the first thing is you're getting genuine loans from others, and they're renouncing the use of that money. They understand they don't have command over that money for the time being. Or the other thing is you're creating fiduciary media. Okay. What is the golden rule of banking? Well, here, let's read the quote. This is from page 263. The credit that the bank grants must correspond quantitatively and qualitatively to the credit that it takes up. More exactly expressed, and then here he's quoting somebody, the date on which the bank's obligations fall due must not precede the date on which its corresponding claims can be realized. So this is, in modern terminology, we would refer to this as maturity matching. And so if you're violating the golden rule, you've engaged in maturity mismatching. And so what would it mean to have to engage in maturity mismatching? In a glib phrase, it would mean to borrow short and lend long. All right, so let me briefly talk about this from a more modern perspective. And everything I'm saying here, Mises would totally, how can I put it? It's not like these principles and concepts I'm going to bring up were invented in 1940. Right, this stuff is that's one of the reasons it's very fun and interesting and historically enlightening to read the theory of money and credit, is because you see, if you really get in the weeds and you read everything, you know, you read every page of it, you can get a sense of just how complex financial markets were even back then. So, I mean, Mises talks about derivatives in the commodities markets, for example. And he acts like, duh, everybody knows this stuff. And, you know, whereas some people might not have thought that in 1912 it would have been just commonplace to talk about derivatives in commodities markets, all right? But it was. So anyway, though, but I'm going to use more modern terminology to talk about this golden rule of banking to make sure you know what Mises is getting at here. So you have what's called a yield curve. Let me just make sure I'm not losing anybody. So the yield curve shows, it's a graph where on the y-axis, actually, can I do that? I'm thinking of, it's not worth me pulling up the whiteboard and doing that. On the y-axis is the interest rate or the yield, the rate of return, and on the x-axis is the maturity, the length of the loan. And so if that is upward sloping, right, so when you draw the series of points or the curve, if it starts low, on the lower left, and then it goes up and to the right, that's what nowadays referred to as a normal yield curve. It's upward sloping, meaning the longer the maturity on the loan, the higher the annual interest rate. So, for example, right now, with the U.S. federal government, if you're going to buy a three-month security issued by the U.S. federal government, you're going to get a very low interest rate. You know, it's almost zero. If you're going to buy something that is one that ties up your money for a year, you're going to get a little bit higher return. If you're willing to buy something that's 10 years, you're going to get an even higher return, and so on. Okay, so to be clear, I'm not merely saying you're going to earn more total interest if you lend your money out for 10 years than if you only lend it out for 3 months. Of course you are. But I'm saying even the annualized rate of return, you know, adjusting for the difference in the duration, the annualized rate at which your money grows exponentially, typically when the yield curve is upward sloping, is higher the longer the further into the future the date on the bond is, when the bond officially matures, put it that way. Okay, and there's various reasons for why that might be, but let's not deal with that right now. That's just a fact that nowadays that's considered normal to have an upward sloping yield curve. Okay, so given that, and especially now with short-term rates being very low, whereas long-term rates are still low, but they're not nearly as, you know, that they're not, they haven't been pushed down proportionally as much as short rates have been. What you can do is you can borrow money from people, you know, from the short term and then lend it out long. And so, you know, a financial institution right now could borrow, I'm just making these numbers up, obviously, but let's say you can borrow money at 1% in terms of 1 year loan. So you borrow $1,000 today, and the person granting you that loan says, okay, 1 year from now, you owe me $1,010. And then you take that $1,000 and then you invest it in some other, you know, company or whatever, and they're offering a 5% interest return, but it's a 10-year loan, right? So they're saying, if you give us $1,000 today, 10 years from now, we're going to give you so much money back that if you calculated the annual rate of return, it would be 5%. Okay, so that's a great, you know, so you earn money on that spread. You're borrowing at 1% and you're lending out at 5%. So you're effectively earning 4% on that spread. But the problem is there's a maturity mismatch. So let's say you get real levered up and you borrow $1 million in those 1 year loans, and you lend $1 million out to this other, you know, entity for 10 years, how are you going to finance that? How are you going to survive? Because when the year rolls around, that organization that you lent the money to, they don't owe you the money. You know, contractually, they only owe it to you in 10 years. And so you have to come up with $1,010 for everybody you borrowed $1,000 from. So typically what you do is you just roll it over. You go back into the credit markets, and you borrow $1,000 from somebody else for 1 year, and you use that $1,000 to pay the principal off of the first person you bought it from or borrowed from previous year, and then you out of pocket come up with the $10 to pay the interest. Okay, and then you just keep doing that. You do it in year three, you do it in year four, you just keep borrowing $1,000 short, you know, for 1 year from somebody to pay off the guy you just borrowed from last year, and you out of pocket pay the $10. So you keep doing that, boom, 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 and then finally in year 10, hopefully that other concern didn't default, and they pay you in full what they said specified contractually, and you pay, you know, the people you borrowed $1,000 from in year 9, you pay all them off, and now you got a big pile of money left over, and it more than compensates for the little interest payments you had to kick in along the way. All right, so that's one way of picturing it. So that works great so long as interest rates don't rise in the meantime. But let's say you start doing that and you're going along great, and then in year four, all of a sudden, because price inflation is going through the roof, the Federal Reserve jacks up interest rates across the board. And let's say every single interest rate for every maturity rises by, you know, 5 percentage points. So now you owe all these people $1,010, and so you want to go back into the market and borrow again, but now people are only going to lend you $1,000 if you agree to pay them 6%. And so, you know, so at that point you either have to just come up with it yourself or you have to borrow it. And the point is, you know, so now all that gain you were hoping to get evaporates. Or what's even worse is, what if you just can't borrow it at all? What if the credit markets freeze up like they did in the fall of 2008? And you have all these long-term investments that are still technically sound, but you were heavily leveraged, and in order to stay afloat, you had been counting on your ability to go into the credit markets and to keep borrowing short-term, to keep rolling over that short-term debt. and now all of a sudden everything freezes up and nobody's lending anymore, then you're dead. And so what do you do? Well, you have to sell off those long-term loans to come up with cash to satisfy your short-term obligations. And so that's the so that's the danger. So Mises is saying here, if you follow the golden rule, you will never be in that situation. Because the golden rule says, if you're going to borrow money from somebody in order to invest it in something, or if you're going to borrow money and lend it out again, make sure the maturity matches. So if you're borrowing money from people and you owe them the money back in 1 year, don't lend it out for something that's more than a year long. If you borrow for a year and lend it to somebody for a year and earn a spread that way, then you're fine. You still have default risk, right? No matter what you do, if you're in the business of banking, you face the danger that if you lend it to people who can't pay you back, you're in trouble. And you know that's going to happen statistically no matter what you do, and so you got to just be careful and make sure the spread you're earning, assuming no default, is high enough so that once you factor in default, it's still, you know, worthwhile for you to do that. All right, so Mises does go on to say that even if you obey the golden rule, you're not totally safe, but he's saying at least then you're protecting yourself from what we would call interest rate risk. So what's happening nowadays is there are a lot of people that are very concerned that with this very low short interest rate environment, that a lot of financial institutions are just going crazy. The ones that are eligible are borrowing very heavily short term and then dumping it into government securities that have a slightly higher rate of return if you go out on the, you know, on the maturity side. And so it's perverse for several reasons, because on the one hand, they're saying what's really happening here is the Fed completely destroyed the ability of conventional savers to earn a return on their money and just totally wrecked, you know, pension plans and things like that, because when interest rates go down, that totally screws up your pension. If you're the, you know, the management, if you're the company managing the pensions, is what I'm saying, because then your assets compared to your future liabilities gets all screwed up. If you thought interest rates are going to be 5% and now they're 0.5% year after year. All right, so a lot of cynics are saying what the Fed has been doing is providing a vehicle for, you know, messing up everybody who's trying to save and providing a vehicle where the banks can earn a very safe, almost guaranteed return by effectively borrowing from the Fed and then lending it to the U.S. government and engaging in a maturity mismatch. So that's bad, you know, for obvious reasons on the face of it, but then also if something gets screwed up and for some reason interest rates have to rise, then all those banks are going to get blown up because they're leveraged, and it, not just banks, but like financial institutions generally who are doing this trade. Okay. Granting credit. So let me just go through some definitions here. So what do we mean by a credit transaction? You know, this is called, is translated as the theory of money and credit. We all know what money is now, but what exactly do we mean by this term credit? And one way of getting closer to understanding that concept is to say, look, a credit transaction involves an exchange of present for future goods. So that should help a little bit. Like, what does it mean when you say, oh, would you give credit to somebody? Or if you think about a credit card company telling you, oh, you applied for one of our cards, here's what your credit limit is. Or to give someone a line of credit, you say, well, you know, what does that mean? Is credit different from money? And yeah, it is. But you say, well, wait a minute, but when I borrow from you, you're giving me money. It's that, you know, you're, I'm not borrowing credit, I'm borrowing money. I mean, that's what I, if I go to the store and run my credit card to buy something, it's not that the merchant got credit, the merchant got money. So what's the distinction? So it's, they're intimately related, but the point is, just think of it this way, if the credit card company is granting you a line of credit of $2,000, that means they're willing to lend you up to $2,000, meaning they're willing to give you $2,000 today in exchange for your promise to pay them back $2,000 in the future, plus, you know, plus interest. And so it's definitely a credit transaction there. And why somebody's trustworthiness comes into play is precisely because of that. Since it is an exchange of present for future goods, a credit transaction only works if the party who's receiving the future goods believes that's going to actually happen, right? Because it's not that you get a time machine. What you're actually getting is some claim saying the other party promises to give you goods in the future. All right, so that's what a credit transaction is. Now, what's commodity credit? Here is where the grantor renounces disposal over goods in the present. All right, so again, if you grant commodity credit to somebody, Mises is saying that means in so doing you're forfeiting or renouncing disposal over goods in the present. So you currently have control of present goods, and you are now going to grant commodity credit to somebody else. You're giving up your control over those present goods in the course of granting the commodity credit. Okay. What about circulation credit? Here Mises says, oh, that's a situation where someone grants credit to somebody, but in so doing, the grantor does not suffer any actual hardship, even though the grantee, the person receiving the credit, enjoys now immediate command over goods that the person didn't enjoy before the transaction. So on the face of it, that seems like a paradox. And actually, it is kind of a paradox, and that's why some of the most hardcore Rothbardian critics of fractional reserve banking think it doesn't make any sense, because they're saying, for precisely this reason, that in fractional reserve banking, it seems to achieve the impossible, where somebody, the person granting the credit, allows the receiver, the recipient of credit, to go out to have command over present goods. You know, that person can go around town and start buying stuff right now and get them in his possession. So he's clearly given power to command control over goods in the economy right now, and yet the grantor of that suffers no hardship. It's not that that person now has a reduction in his ability to command control over goods in the economy right now. And so that seems like, well, how is that possible? So the answer, of course, is that circulation credit involves the issuance of fiduciary media. Okay, so slide 4 here. How is fiduciary media possible? And so this is just reiterating some points Mises made earlier, but it's crucial, so let's just go ahead and read this again. So this is page 267. Mises says, the fact that is peculiar to money alone I stressed the wrong syllables. Hang on, let's try again. The fact that is peculiar to money alone is not that mature and secure claims to money are as highly valued in commerce as the sums of money to which they refer, but rather that such claims are complete substitutes for money, able to fulfill all the functions of money in those markets in which their essential characteristics of maturity and security are recognized. It is this circumstance that makes it possible to issue more of this sort of substitute than the issuer is always in a position to convert. Okay, I'm just checking ahead to see if I include this quote. I don't remember if it's right around here or if it was elsewhere. Maybe I already covered this, but let me just say it again in case I already did say it. So Mises contrasts, you know, claim tickets to money with claim tickets to bread. And he says that if suppose there were somebody, some institution that everybody knew had a bunch of bread, physical loaves of bread on supply, you know, in stock, and then there were these tickets floating around the community, and said the bearer of this ticket, if you show up at our store or our branch office and you turn this ticket over, we immediately will give you a loaf of bread. So Mises is saying, as long as the community genuinely believed in the validity of that claim, that yes, it would be honored upon demand, there's no practical doubt about the fact that it would be immediately paid and that the operation wouldn't go bankrupt or anything. Then he says, in terms of value theory and how would the community evaluate those claims, they would receive the same value as if they were the bread itself. Incidentally, just a little side note, I think there's a bit of a problem there because technically you would still have to, if you wanted to have the bread to eat, you would rather get the loaf in an exchange than the ticket because you'd have to go turn the ticket in. So I think that's not quite right, but what Mises is getting at here is, for all intents and purposes, that it's basically the same thing, that those tickets would be just about as good as bread in that situation. But having said that, that from there it doesn't follow that therefore the firm or the entity that it was in the business of warehousing loaves of bread and issuing tickets that promised immediate convertibility of the ticket into the physical loaf of bread, they wouldn't be able to issue fiduciary media. He's saying if you only had 1,000 loaves in storage, you wouldn't want to issue more than 1,000 tickets. Because he says the only real use of those tickets is at some point somebody is going to get it who wants to eat the bread and is going to turn the thing in and get the bread and eat it, and that's going to extinguish it. And so that's the distinction with this quote that I have here on the slide. That's what he's getting at in the beginning. So he's saying it's not peculiar to money that mature and secure claims to it are as highly valued in commerce as the sums of money itself, because he's saying even in commerce, mature and secure claims to loaves of bread would be valued as highly as the loaves of bread themselves would be. He's saying, but what is special about money is, since it's never actually consumed, that the only reason you accept money is to then trade it away to somebody else. That's why it is valued qua money, as a medium of exchange. And so that's why these claim tickets to the money can circulate indefinitely without ever being redeemed, whereas if for some reason you did ever get in a situation where people were passing around these claim tickets to bread, eventually, each ticket would get used, because the only reason to have those tickets in that market would be to satisfy people who wanted to eat the bread. That'd be the only reason anyone would accept those. So it's true, just to be clear, it's true some people might accept those claim tickets as a medium of exchange, intending to just trade it away to somebody else, right? So even somebody who didn't want bread, I'm trying to think of an example. If somebody owes you money and you go to their house and you say, hey, or like a landlord, let's say, he knocks on your door and says, hey, where's the rent this month? And the person says, I don't have it. I know I owe you these gold coins. I don't have it. But look, I have these claim tickets to 100 loaves of bread. Would you take these? And perhaps, at a discount, right? Because I know you'd rather get money, but here's this. The landlord might take it. And so you could see how you know, and he knows, well, I'll just go out in the community and sell these things. But the point is, who's he going to sell it to? Yeah, conceivably there could be somebody else who gets it, you know, he sells it at a discount maybe, but the people he's going to sell it to are probably going to be the people who are going to go eat bread. You see how that works? Whereas if he says to the guy, to the person, the tenant, hey, it's the first of the month, you owe me the rent, where is it? You owe me 10 gold, or let's say you owe me one gold coin. And the guy says, oh, I don't actually have a physical gold coin, but I have this money certificate, or sorry, this money substitute issued by the bank that says the bearer of this can turn it in and get one gold coin. Would you take this instead? He'll say sure, because he knows he can go in the community and sell it, trade it away for other things, and so that's why he accepts it in lieu of a physical gold coin. But notice here, it's not because he knows there's a bunch of people in the community that are pining to get their hands on physical gold coins. Even the people he in turn trades it away to are going to do the same thing. They're going to trade it away. You know what I mean? There's not going to be this hustle to take those things and go to the bank and turn it in for gold coins. Whereas if the tenant just had nothing on him except these claim tickets for loaves of bread, the landlord might reluctantly take those and then go in the community and see what he could get for them. But the point is, the people he's selling it to are going to be using it to go get bread. Because if you think about, why would you, except in odd situations like the one I said there, where the landlord is owed money and the guy doesn't have any money, and so it's an issue of, well, geez, what can you give me? And the guy gives him tickets to bread. Except for weird situations like that, no one's going to go and voluntarily try to get these claim tickets to bread unless they really want to go get bread. Whereas in a healthy market where the banks have established their reputation, the money substitutes really are substitutes for money, that they're interchangeable as far as the merchants are concerned in day-to-day transactions. And so anybody who wants money is willing to accept those claim tickets to money. Okay, so that's what Mises is getting at here. So make sure you understand that. Now, because of that, so the point is, whatever it is that money does, and again, as always here, we're talking about money as money. So if it's gold, there are things that a physical gold coin can do that a claim ticket can't, because you can melt the physical gold coin down and use it in industrial purposes as gold. But the point is that if you decide to do that, now it's not money anymore, or it's not serving as a medium of exchange, I should say. It's now just being used as a commodity, right? But so in its capacity to serve as a medium of exchange, a gold coin is indistinguishable in its serviceability from a note issued by a bank, so long as the community has no doubts about the redeemability and security of that note. Okay, so that's what Mises is getting at. And so once you realize that, you see how it can be possible for banks to get away with issuing fiduciary media, whereas that wouldn't work for any other thing. So that you could have claim tickets to things, or like a silo that stores wheat wouldn't want to be issuing more claims than it had wheat backing it up. What's interesting here, and I'll just mention this and move on, is I wonder how true that is. Because I know there are lots of people that say in financial markets today, there are like hedge funds that will short stocks when they don't actually have the underlying shares. That it's called a naked short. Okay, so just in case you don't know what that means. So right now, let's say you're a hedge fund and you're really sure that IBM is going to go down 5%. You think there's a bad report coming out next week and you're pretty sure that the share price of IBM stock is going to go down 5% and that other people in the market aren't aware of this news that you are. So obviously if you currently own IBM stock, you would sell it before the news hits and the price goes down. But suppose you don't own it, but you still think the price is going to go down. How do you profit from that? Well, you short sell it. So technically what you would do is you would borrow 1,000 shares from somebody who currently owns it, then you would sell it. The news comes out next week, the price goes down 5%, you buy back the 1,000 shares at the lower price, and then you return them to the original owner who lent you his shares. And then, you know, you pay him some sort of fee for the privilege of borrowing his shares for a week or whatever. And that's how so that's the deal. So you sell at what you think is the higher price, and you buy back at the lower price. So that obviously works if you're correct, and it hurts you if it goes the other way. If you're wrong and you try to short sell and the price goes up, well, then you eat the difference because you sold at a lower price and had to buy them back at a higher price. But with a naked short, the idea is that you technically are selling shares of stock that you don't have physical control over. Not physical is not even the right word. That you don't have control over, that you actually didn't acquire the shares from a current owner before selling them. And if you say, well, how is that possible? Well, just the way that the brokerages work and the exchanges work and things, they kind of let you do stuff and then just assume that you'll settle up with a cash payment and so on. And so that leads to an issue of where you can see that on certain transactions that more shares of a company are being sold than exist. And so that leads to, you know, people get mad and some companies say they're getting targeted by short sellers and that, you know, what can you do to defend yourself against that? Because in principle, a company could buy back all of its shares. Like, you know, if they wanted to maintain the share price, and let's say there's a bunch of short sellers who are really trying to push down the price, you might think, okay, well, the worst case scenario, how would you defend yourself if you're actually a well-run company and you want to support your share price? You could buy back the share. So if people are short selling, you know, let's say the price right now is 100 and the short sellers come in and they kind of want to dump the stock and push it down to 80, but you want to maintain it at least at 90, you could just have a standing offer and say, oh, we'll buy all the shares at 90. And what would the limit be? Ultimately, you would buy back every outstanding share, and you would own, you know, just the principal investors or whatever would own all the shares. And then what could the short sellers do? The short seller would come to you and say, we want to borrow it and dump it. And you say, no, you can't. Right? So you would think that would nip it in the bud, but actually, if the short sellers are allowed to sell shares that they don't even have control over, well, then that can push your share price down. There's nothing you can do. Right? So that's what people are alleging happens, and I don't know enough. I mean, my limited investigations, it looks like that does happen. So anyway, my point from going off on that tangent was just to say, I don't know that it's correct with Mises. Just matter-of-factly assumes this couldn't happen in other markets. I think people are saying that it could happen, and the question's then just, well, I guess the issue is when it comes back to bite you, what happens? Because here, to finish that story, what these people claim, you know, it was the guy, I don't know, anybody who's tuned in here, do you guys happen to know what I'm talking about? It's Overstock.com, that's the company. So the president or the CEO, I don't remember what his title is, or the founder, but the guy who runs Overstock.com actually has this campaign out to change the rules of how the financial sector is regulated, because he claims these short sellers keep dumping his stock and they're doing it with shares they don't have control over. And so they're engaging in naked shorting of his stock. And he says that, you know, what more could I do? What I do is I go and I buy it up. You know, so these guys want to sell 1,000 shares of my stock. So I buy it from them. And then I ask, and then, you know, the price either goes down or doesn't go down, doesn't really matter. And then I ask them, okay, you sold shares of my stock, I bought it from you, give me the actual shares. You know, so not that you mail it to me, but, you know, have your broker give it to my broker. Because you sold 1,000 shares and I bought it from you, so great. And give it to my broker, you know, because he's trying to, like, call their bluff, in other words. And then what happens is they come back and say, you know, his broker will come back and say, sorry, we can't produce the shares we'll just break that original transaction and act like it didn't happen. So, you know, we'll give you your money back and pretend that the trade never happened. Sorry about that. So that's kind of where so I guess Mises is right, actually. It's just if the legal system doesn't enforce contracts, then I guess all bets are off. But that's, anyway, there's a nice tangent for you to relate it to present event. Okay, slide number 5. Mises says that fiduciary media can therefore influence the quantity of money and the purchasing power of money. So I put up this chart again that I really like from the translator. So remember, you got this broad thing at the top, money in the broader sense, and then that consists of money in the narrower sense plus money substitutes. And so money in the narrower sense includes commodity money, credit money, and fiat money. So I'm trying to think of the best way to describe this. Why don't we start with the way the world is right now? So I think most people listening to this are in a country where there's fiat money. Probably most of us are either use US dollars or euros. All right, so in our world, money in the narrower sense, the thing that is actually the money in our societies is that fiat money. So the United States, it is Federal Reserve notes, you know, $100 bills with pictures of Benjamin Franklin on them, $20 bills with Andrew Jackson and so on. Or in the euro area, it's the euro, the pieces of paper. That is the money. Also technically, but don't worry if you don't understand this, would be the reserves of the commercial banks with the central bank. So commercial banks that have reserves on deposit with the Fed, that would be what's called base money also. That stuff is effectively legally as good as a piece of paper Federal Reserve note. And the same thing in Europe, the commercial banks that have reserve balances with the European Central Bank, those things legally are as good as the Federal Reserve notes. And why is that, in case you're curious? Because if you have those, so you know, Chase Bank has $1 million on deposit with the Fed, so it's like Chase has a checking account with the Fed and there's $1 million in it, Chase has the right to withdraw those funds. And what happens if Chase says to the Fed, hey, electronically here, our account says we have $1 million on deposit with you. We would like that to withdraw that, please, and close our account down. The Fed would just tell the Bureau of Engraving and Printing, print up $1 million worth of currency, green pieces of paper, and then put it in an armored car and drive it over to Chase and give it to them. And then they take those green pieces of paper and they can put it in their vault. Okay, so that's why legally, from the commercial bank's point of view, if it has electronic deposits with the central bank, that is effectively the same thing as if they have the currency, the printed pieces of paper in their vault, because legally the central bank is obligated to produce those pieces of paper upon demand. Okay, so that's what's called the monetary base. And that is the money, that's money in the narrower sense. So you're walking around town and you've got a $20 bill in your wallet. You clearly have money. There's nothing more basic in today's society than that in terms of the money. If it were commodity money, it would be like coins that were made out of gold. And that would be obviously, that would be the base. There would be nothing more fundamental than that. And then the same thing with credit money, but let's not talk about credit, because credit money is kind of screwy, and we're just going to get mixed up if we think about that. But it would be the same thing there, that would be the fundamental thing. Okay. But now you can broaden that conception and talk about money substitutes. So here, again, what is a money substitute? It is a claim on the base money, the money in the narrower sense, where that claim is immediately redeemable, and there's no doubt about its reliability or its redeemability. Okay. And notice, by the way, that those are two separate things. In case some of you are wondering, you know, isn't that just being redundant? No, those are two separate things, because you could imagine something that there's no doubt about its reliability or its redeemability, but the claim itself says this only matures 8 months from now. Okay, so it's a, whereas on the other hand, the claim could say this is immediately, this is payable upon demand, but everybody thinks, yeah, I doubt it. I bet you if you showed up and showed it to the guy, they would say they didn't have it. Okay, so that's why Mises stresses the two-pronged thing there for what makes something a money substitute, is that it has to purport to be payable upon demand, and the general consensus of the community is that that will be honored, that there's, you know, that you don't have to worry about them breaking that promise. Okay, so that's what money substitutes are. Now, so those are those claims. So now, if those claims are 100% backed by the actual money in the narrower sense, whatever it may be, then that money substitute is called a money certificate. However, if it's not backed 100%, if this quantity of money substitutes that are claims upon money in the narrower sense, if there's more of them than there are stockpiles of money in the narrower sense in the vaults of the banks that are issuing these money substitutes, then the portion of the money substitutes that are completely unbacked are fiduciary media. Okay, and that's why Mises, you know, or the editor, translator, I should say, you know, under this heading of fiduciary media has uncovered bank deposits and notes. And there's also token money. Let's not worry about that. In the Q&A, if you want to ask me, we can talk about that, but I think it's going to screw you up right now. Okay, so back to our modern day world. What is a money substitute? It is your checking account balance, for example, or deposit, I should say. Right? So you have $1,000 in currency, in $100 bills. Or you have 1,000 euros, and you have it in, you know, 100 euro notes. You go to a commercial bank and you deposit it with them. Now, what do you have? Well, you no longer have actual notes from your central bank in your possession. Now, what you have is something issued by the commercial bank saying you have this on deposit with us. So that's why it's weaker now. Make sure you catch that. That you no longer have direct control over the base money, money in the narrower sense. Now you've converted that into a money substitute. So you're still thinking, no, I still have my $1,000. See, let's go to the ATM machine. And you put in your debit card, you type in your PIN, and you say balance, and it shows up on the screen. You say, look, it says $1,000 on deposit with Chase Bank in my checking account. So I still have $1,000. But if you think about it, technically, that's not the same thing as you having the $1,000 in currency. Because really what you have is a promise by Chase that if you asked them, they would give you $1,000 in currency. Or that if you write a check and say, pay to the order of Jim Smith $1,000 and sign your name and give it to him, that he can go to his bank, present it, they'll present it to Chase, and then Chase will give his bank $1,000 in actual currency and then credit his account. Right, so you see how that works, that the claims of the banks, which constitute what we think of as checking account balances or deposits, and the things that back up our debit card swipes and our writing checks to each other, those things are claims or promises that the bank makes saying, if asked, we will produce money in the narrower sense, which in our world happens to be fiat money. But in principle, it could be commodity money if we had a commodity money world. Okay, precisely because the way the community and merchants interact in modern commerce, most people on a day-to-day basis don't distinguish between money in the narrower sense versus money substitutes. That's why Mises thinks it's helpful to bring them all under the umbrella of money in the broader sense. So that's why he thinks it's okay to say you're, you know, the individual household, when he takes his $1,000 in currency, puts it on deposit in his checking account in the bank, and now is walking around with his checkbook thinking, I can write, you know, if I want to buy something that costs $1,000, I'm in the same position as I was before I made the deposit. It's just, it's more convenient for me to have this checkbook that I can write a check for $1,000 rather than walking around with 10 $100 bills or, you know, 50 $20 bills. And so that if I wanted to buy that thing, I would have to count out 50 $20 bills and hand to the guy. I can just write him a check. So that person still thinks I have the same amount of money. Okay, and so Mises is saying that's a very plausible thing. As economists, we need to be careful, or we need to have the ability to distinguish money in the narrower sense, money in the broader, precisely because of the quirks caused by fiduciary media. And so that's why he has those terms. That's why he has those concepts. But since it is the case that people use that stuff interchangeably, that's why Mises says, yeah, it's okay to call it money. Just make sure you say in the broader sense. Okay, last thing on this slide, and then we'll move on here. So now that you notice now, so now we see how it is that the commercial banks have the ability to change the total quantity of money in existence. Because now the commercial banks have the ability to issue fiduciary media, and since we know that fiduciary media are part of money substitutes, and money substitutes are part of money in the broader sense, that means the commercial banks have the ability to alter the quantity of money in the broader sense. The commercial banks can't alter the amount of money in the narrower sense, right? So if the money is U.S. Federal Reserve notes, if you're in the United States right now, that's fiat money, that's the base money. Commercial banks can't change that number. No matter what the commercial banks do, they cannot alter how many literal $100 green pieces of paper exist. They can't print that. They do not have the legal authority to print money. And the commercial banks do not have the authority to create reserves with the Fed. All the commercial banks can do is create deposits for their customers with them. So Chase Bank has the legal ability to, out of thin air, create a deposit with Chase saying Fred Smith now has $1,000 on deposit with us. They can do that legally. But Chase cannot say, hey, guys, fire up the printing press and print $1,000 in $100 bills and we're going to give it to him. They can't do that. Okay, so again, once you understand why checking account balances count in money in the broader sense, then you see why banks, commercial banks, you know, private sector commercial banks have the ability to alter the quantity of money. And so then if you understand what drives the purchasing power of money, and one of the things clearly is the the amount of money, well, then now you see why commercial banks have the ability to change money's purchasing power. Okay, well, sorry, one last point here, and then we'll move on. Notice, I'm just trying to make sure you see how this all fits together. If you had 100% reserve banking, if all money substitutes were money certificates, then the commercial banks would have no power to do any of this stuff. Because there, what would happen is, if a customer went up to a bank, and remember, fiat money and fractional reserve banking are distinct concepts. You can have fiat money with 100% reserve banking. You can have fiat money with fractional reserve banking. You could have commodity money with 100% reserve banking. You could have commodity money with fraction reserve banking. Okay, so just make sure you understand those. Typically, with governments taking over stuff, you end up with fiat money and fraction reserve banking. That's what the central banks foist upon us, but they're different things. Okay, so what I'm saying is, let's just imagine, what would it mean if we had fiat money but 100% reserve banking? Well, that would mean, yes, there's the base money is $100 bill, you know, green pieces of paper, or euro notes, pieces of paper issued by the ECB. But the commercial banks, if you went and deposited that in your account, they wouldn't. All they could do is acknowledge the fact that you had that on deposit. They couldn't then advance loans to other people pyramided on top of your deposit. So if you had $1,000 in cash and currency and you went and deposited it at your bank, all they could do was give you a money certificate, which in our day and age would mean they would credit your checking account by $1,000. So you still think you had the same amount of money, and there would be no one else in society who thought he had any more, because the bank could not in turn then go lend money. You know, they couldn't lend $900 to somebody who wants to go buy a used car for $900, whereas under fractional reserve banking they can. All right, so I suppose, in case you're getting confused here, you might say, well, but wait a minute. With money in the broader sense, let's say originally there's no deposits in the banking system at all. Let's say we start out with $1 trillion and everyone's just walking around with $1 trillion in physical pieces of paper currency in their wallets and purses, and now they take half of that, $500 billion, and they go deposit it in 100% reserve commercial banks, and they get money certificates for that. So you might plausibly ask me, wouldn't now money in the broader sense be $1.5 trillion? Because you've still got the trillion and the pieces of, you know, Federal Reserve notes, $100 bills, and so on. And now on top of that, you have the $500 billion in demand deposits. And so wouldn't that push up prices? That's not normally the way economists would classify that. Usually when they would, money in the broader sense, you wouldn't normally count that. You would say, no, you're just substituting the one for the other. So you, in other words, you wouldn't double count. You wouldn't say, oh yeah, that person has $1,000 in his mind on deposit with Chase, and Chase also has $1,000 in the vault backing that up, and therefore I'm going to count that as $2,000 in the total money in the broader sense. That's not typically the way you would count that. However, what you would do is you would say, that person, if there's fractional reserve banking, that person puts $1,000 in the vault to Chase, and now Chase says, okay, your checking account balance is $1,000 higher, and then Chase on top of that lends $900 to this guy over here who wants to borrow a used car, who wants to buy a used car. You would count the $900 because, you know, either Chase takes the $900 in currency out of the vault and gives it to him, or it just makes his checking account balance go up by $900. So, you know, even accounting for the fact that you don't want to do the double counting, with fractional reserve banking, clearly the money supply in the broader sense goes up. And so just make sure you get how that works. Okay. So you can see how, so since the banks increase fiduciary media through their lending, you can see now how this all starts tying together, and we're getting real close to the Misesian theory of the trade cycle. You can see how the commercial banks in their lending decisions, which is going to be tied to the rate of interest, obviously, influences money, the quantity of money in the broader sense, and how that can change the purchasing power of money. You start to see how this stuff all ties together. Okay, deposit banking. Hang on, let me just flip ahead and make sure, see how much we got to do here. Okay, yeah, again, I got to speed it up. Okay, so I'm on slide 6 called deposit banking. All right, so Mises says, it is customary to describe the deposit of money into a checking account as a credit transaction, but this is wrong from the economic point of view. And the reason is, because remember, for Mises, a true credit transaction means one party is giving up command over present goods in exchange for promised future goods. So in a genuine credit transaction, I might go to a bank and buy a CD for $1,000, certificate of deposit, and the CD pays 2% interest. That's a one-year thing, right? So they're saying, you give us $1,000 today, you get this CD from us, and the CD says, come back in 1 year, and we will give you $1,020. So there, that is a genuine credit transaction. I am giving up my $1,000. I can't walk around town writing checks on it. It's not my money anymore. What I do have instead is this asset that's a promise by the bank saying the bearer of this thing will get $1,020 next year. Now, let's be clear. Let's say 3 months into this deal, I am in trouble. You know, my son has a medical condition. He needs to go to the doctor for something, and I need to raise money. I can't wait 12 months to get my $1,020. I'm allowed to go into the secondary market and try to sell that CD to somebody else. Okay, so when we say a credit transaction involves a renunciation of present goods for future goods, you can try to transfer that to somebody else in the meantime. If you don't want to be the one who has to wait the full time, you can try to get somebody else to come in and you know, step into your place, as it were. So then that person, at that point, you know, 3 months into it, gives up present goods, and now that person is going to wait the remaining 9 months until the bank honors the CD by giving the $1,020 to whoever happens to be holding that CD. Okay, so but the issue is, you're not sure what you're going to get for it if you want to do that. So that's why you're taking a risk up front when you give your $1,000 to the bank in exchange for the bank's promise to pay you $1,020 in exactly 1 year's time, is because you know if you wanted access to money sooner than that, the bank doesn't have to give it to you. The best you can do is try to auction off that claim that they gave you and see what you get for it, see what the market will bear 3 months into it. Okay? So what Mises is saying, what I'm talking about here on this first arrow, is Mises is when you, if you deposit money into a checking account, I think Mises probably calls it a demand deposit. I'm calling it a checking account because that's kind of the way we think about it today, what it is. He said that's typically, even when he was writing, people would call that, oh, that's a credit transaction, because people think what banks do is engage in credit transactions, and so if you're giving your money to the bank, oh, it must be a credit transaction. But he's saying, no, if what you are doing is depositing money into a demand account where you think you have the legal right to access your money at a moment's notice, as opposed to, you know, buying a CD where you don't have a legal right to get the money back, he said that's not a credit transaction because nobody's giving up command over present goods. Okay, so this issue of out of thin air. So just to be clear, I'm putting the quotations around this phrase out of thin air on this slide. I'm not quoting Mises directly. It's not that Mises says out of thin air. I am just saying we like to use this phrase a lot, those of us who cast aspersions on fractional reserve banking. And one of the great way to do that, the great way, you know, if I'm doing a radio interview and I'm getting all worked up into a lather complaining about Bernanke, and the guy, you know, the guy, the host of the radio show is on my side and he wants me to go and, you know, give him hell, Bob, this is a great way to do it, to identify with the common man and to say, and so Bernanke's out there, you know, buying assets and just, where do those Federal Reserve deposits come from? Where do those reserves come from? Is it because Bernanke has been saving up, cutting lawns and babysitting for the last 30 years, and he's been building up a little piggy bank, and that's how he's buying all these mortgage-backed securities and government bonds? No. The $1 trillion that he injects into the system in a few months, he created out of thin air. Just by writing those checks, he created the money that backed him up. And so for a lot of people to hear the distinguished PhD economist describing it like that, it horrifies them. Oh, my gosh, our system is built on a house of cards. We're all screwed. And so we like to use that phrase. Okay. So what I'm showing you here is Mises, in a much more gentlemanly, scholarly way, is making this point that to a lot of people, until they hear it explained, they don't think, they think it can't possibly be true because that's too screwy. Okay, so here's Mises on page 271. The loans are granted out of a fund. So the context here, he's talking about a commercial bank issuing fiduciary media. It's granting a circulation credit to one of its customers here, to a borrower. So Mises says, the loans are granted out of a fund that did not exist before the loans were granted. In all other circumstances, whenever loans are granted, they are granted out of the existing and available funds of wealth. But those banks that issue notes or open current accounts that are fiduciary media have a fund from which to grant loans over and above their own resources and those resources of other people that are at their disposal. All right, so again, just read that sentence again. When a bank grants a loan of fiduciary media to somebody, the loans are granted out of a fund that did not exist before the loans were granted. Right, so that's, love it or hate it, make sure you understand that that's what fractional reserve banking involves. And the reason I stress this is because I didn't even understand this even when I had a PhD and was teaching at Hillsdale College. In my earlier understanding, I thought that only the central bank had the ability to create money out of thin air, and then the commercial banks just kind of moved it around. And I mean, I understood the money multiplier process, how, oh, the Fed injects $1 million in new reserves, and then that gets deposited, and then the commercial bank lends out $900,000, and then that gets deposited, and they lend out, $810,000, blah, blah, blah. I would teach that just like anybody else would at the intro level, but it never really struck me, and I think I even incorrectly taught my students the first time I taught, I guess that would be principles of macro, that where's this magic coming from? And I said, oh, it's because the government gives the central bank this privilege to create money out of thin air. Because they can just buy assets. They can just write checks and buy an asset, and the funds are automatically there. The Fed, by definition, can't bounce a check. And that was the way I would describe it. And that's what I thought the source was of inflation in terms of increases in the quantity of money. And I was wrong. I wasn't seeing the full picture. It is actually the commercial banks who also create money out of thin air, if you want to use that phrase. So just make sure you get that. And again, I know there are probably some people taking this class that agree with the free bankers. So just to put my cards on the table, I don't. I do think there's something fishy with fractional reserve banking, but there is a very respectable viewpoint that says in a free market, fractional reserve banking is fine. And that's guys like Steve Horowitz and George Selgin and Larry White would advance that position, right? So I'm not saying they're idiots. It's a genuine debate we have. But what I'm wanting to say is they would agree with this too. They think it's cool that, hey, isn't that neat that under fractional reserve banking, the commercial banks can lend money, and the very act of lending it brings it into existence. So that's what you need to understand, because I think many of us still harken back to, and this is kind of the intuition. So Steve Horowitz would say it's a primitive intuition, it's irrational, but I kind of think, how can you lend money to somebody if you don't first have the money? That doesn't make any sense, right? You have to have the money first before you can lend it to somebody. And under fractional reserve banking, you don't have to. The very act of you lending it to someone creates the money that you're lending to them. So that's kind of weird. So again, you can either be fascinated, it's sort of like quantum physics. You know, Einstein said, oh, God doesn't play dice, because it horrified him, some of the implications of what quantum physics was leading people to, whereas other people might say, oh, this is the coolest thing ever. You know, the little particle doesn't know if it's a particle or a wave until we look. That's awesome. You know, some people are horrified by it, some people think it's cool. Same thing here with fractional reserve banking. Perhaps the dinosaurs like Walter Block and me are horrified by something that's actually cool. But the point is, make sure you get why this is so weird. Okay, gotta move on. Fiduciary media, pros and cons. Okay, so now we're getting into some of the controversial stuff. Again, let me just stress, in the modern Austrian libertarian arguments over fractional reserve banking, even though technically it doesn't matter which position Ludwig von Mises had, right, because he's not God, he could have been wrong. Nonetheless, it's always fun to say, well, what did Mises think? Was Mises with us, the people who are for 100% reserve banking, or was he with the free banking side, the people who think a free market should, you know, be allowed to have fractional reserve banking? Again, the problem is, I'm sure I've said this before, but I'll say it again just to make sure there's no misunderstanding. In my estimation, Mises is a little bit, for sure he's unclear, and he's arguably inconsistent, meaning he contradicts himself in a theory of money and credit. That you could read certain passages where it sure looks like he's saying, phew, it's a good thing we had fractional reserve banking or we would have been in trouble. And then there's other passages where it looks like he's saying fractional reserve banking is a danger and needs to be outlawed. So just if in your reading you're thinking, oh, man, I must be an idiot because it looks like over here Mises was saying one thing, but over here he's saying something else, so I just must be stupid. Don't worry. The people who study this stuff for a living can't come to a consensus either. All right, so just be reassured in that respect. Okay, so one of the famous passages from this book where if you want to say, no, Mises, at least back then, was gung-ho, he thought fractional reserve banking was great, would be this passage from page 323 where Mises says, the progressive extension of the money economy would have led to an enormous extension in the demand for money if its efficiency had not been extraordinarily increased by the creation of fiduciary media. The issue of fiduciary media has made it possible to avoid the convulsion that would be involved in an increase in the objective exchange value of money. All right, so what does he mean there? Put it in plain English. He's saying, the world economy became more integrated. 1600s, 1700s, 1800s, going into the early 1900s, as we went from being isolated markets, you know, in Western Europe and then spreading around the world, that especially with the classical period of the gold standard and relatively unfettered free trade, at least among the what we call the Western nations, that would have led to, or that did lead to, a huge increase in the demand for money for various reasons. Population's increasing. As everybody starts using gold as their money, that increases the demand to hold gold for monetary purposes and so on. So that would, other things equal, a huge increase in the demand for money, what would happen? That would raise the exchange value of a unit of money, which means prices quoted in terms of money would collapse. And that would be, Mises says, that would have involved convulsions. So it's true that would have spurred the mining of more gold, but still, that would have just been, you know, that would have just partially offset the fact that there was a humongous increase in the demand, right? So you've got a supply curve and the demand shifts way to the right. It is true that you're going to move up the supply curve so that the quantity supplied increases, but nonetheless, you're going to end up in the new equilibrium at a much higher price. So with money, to say a higher price means there was a massive price deflation of everything else quoted in terms of that money unit. All right, so Mises is saying that convulsion didn't have to happen because in addition to drawing forth more gold from mines, or, you know, drawing gold out of other possible uses because it was more important to be used as money, effectively, it's like there was we tapped into a magic source of artificial gold by the commercial banks issuing claims to gold that weren't actually backed up by gold. So it was like we sort of multiplied the ability of the existing physical stock of gold to serve as money. And so this is why the proponents of free banking think it's so cool when it's done within the discipline of contracts and a market economy without the government screwing with things is because it's kind of neat. That if we know that the absolute quantity of money confers no benefits on society, you know, Mises believes that, well, then if we could come up with some way, some institutional mechanism by which we could effectively have more gold to just prevent massive price adjustments, well, then why would we want to do that? So that's where they're coming from. And it seems in this passage Mises is agreeing with that sentiment. Okay. Now here, let me just make sure Mises doesn't go too far in his congratulations about the benefits of fiduciary media. In this same section of the book, the next page, he starts talking about why people might prefer using fiduciary media to the commodity money itself. And he has some cool things about the smooth faces of the gold coins tell no tales. And he has some flowery language. And what he means there is, it's especially if you're carrying around a lot of money, it's a lot safer to do it in the form of money substitutes. Because if somebody steals your checkbook, for example, and it has a bunch of blank checks, yeah, you're going to be concerned, but the person's not going to be able to go to a car dealership and buy a car and, you know, put $10,000, pay the oil, and then sign your name. I mean, I guess the person could try, but that's a lot riskier, and there's a much better chance the person's going to get arrested and that you're actually not going to lose those funds than if you had $10,000 in currency on you, like you were going to the casino or something, you just had a bunch of actual cash, and then a mugger comes to you in the alley and sticks a gun in your belly and takes it. That's it. That money's gone. There's no way you can get that back. You can't put out an APB saying, be on the lookout for someone who has $20 bills with pictures of Andrew Jackson on them. You know, everyone's got that. That's indistinguishable. There's nothing with, or if it's commodity money and you have gold coins, there's nothing tying those gold coins to your identity. So if you lose them or if somebody steals them from you, you're out of luck. Whereas if you have a checkbook account that's got your name on it and everything like that, and if somebody writes the check, they can have the security camera and look at the, and figure, you know, they can trace and say, wait a minute, where did those funds get spent? So even if someone does go into a store and writes a check for $100 and the merchant accepts it and gives them the goods, after the fact, the investigators, the detectives and whatever can figure out, okay, the person who stole this guy's checkbook, where did he end up, where did he go and spend the money? And then they can see if there's surveillance cameras or whatever. Whereas if the person steals your Federal Reserve notes, we can't then say, okay, let's look at the community a half an hour after the crime and see who is spending $20 bills. Well, that'd be stupid because it'd be all over the place. You see the problem? Okay, so Mises here is explaining in this section why actually in many respects, and it sounds like he's saying these are other reasons that the spread of fiduciary media was a good thing, but I'm just pointing out in this slide, well, that by itself has nothing to do with fiduciary media versus money certificates. All Mises is doing right there is explaining why money substitutes might be preferred in certain circumstances to the underlying money in a narrower sense. So that by itself, these are observations don't have anything to do with is fiduciary media good for the economy or not. That these things could all be satisfied by money certificates, except if you want to couple it with an argument, which Mises does seem like he's doing, so in his defense, maybe this is where he's coming from. If you want to say the only way for the banks to stay in business and issue money substitutes is if they're making money, as it were, earning a profit, earning an income by engaging in the issuance of fiduciary media. That if you want to argue, just practically speaking, there wouldn't be banks issuing money substitutes if they were just money certificates, because what would be in it for them? And then just practically, they couldn't charge enough to cover their overhead and whatever. If that's where you're coming from, then okay. And maybe that's what Mises means. Okay, last slide here, and it looks like I'm not going to have time to answer the questions, but I think this was really important stuff, so I think it's a good use of time. Okay, last slide, dangers. So here, obviously, one of the dangers is the issuance of fiduciary media causes the boom-bust cycle, but I'm not talking about it here because Mises doesn't really get into it. So I'm just talking about thus far in the discussion that Mises has given us, he's talked about some of the benefits of fiduciary media, but what dangers has he also raised in this discussion, right? So he doesn't come out and say this explicitly, but he alludes to the fact that legislatures across the board have adopted various measures to restrain the issuance of fiduciary media. And you get the sense that the people doing that thought that they had to, because they recognized there is a danger. We don't want to just have unrestricted issuance of fiduciary media, because that's going to blow up in our faces. So that's part of it. We'll see later on what Mises thinks of these various measures. But the point is, already we see hints that this is a very dangerous thing. It's sort of like fire. You know, if it's your servant, okay, but if it's your master, you're in trouble. Same thing here, where Mises is talking about historically the benefits of fiduciary media, but he keeps coming back to various governments and central bankers, and so they all recognized that we have to have strict limits on this thing, because there's a danger involved to just having commercial banks expand the quantity of money without limit. The other point he makes is that, and this is all with the discussion near the end of the assigned reading about the cover for the deposits and so on, and Mises is criticizing some of the views of people who think that the bank has a partial redemption fund in order to instill confidence. And Mises is saying that's not really quite right. That he's saying, look, there's no such thing as partial confidence. Either the bank has it with respect to people's belief that it will redeem its money substitutes, or it doesn't. It's not that half the community trusts the bank and the other half doesn't, because if half of the community doesn't trust it, and they're going to go and redeem those money substitutes the moment they get them, well, then the other half knows that, and they're going to rush to get their money out first. See what I'm saying? So in other words, if you wake up a Tuesday morning and there's a big line at your bank where you happen to have all of your checking accounts, or you know, all your money that's in a checking account is in this one bank, and there's a big line out the door on a Tuesday morning, you say, hey, what are you doing, Jim? And he says, I heard that this bank made a bunch of bad real estate loans, and so I'm getting my money out. And that's what everyone in this line is doing. What are you going to do? You're going to get at the end of the line. Even if you – not only if you had no idea about those real estate loans, but even if you've investigated that and you thought, no, those loans are solid, the fact that everybody else is starting to take their money out means you have to get in line too, at least before the advent of – deposit insurance, where the government comes in and guarantees checking account balances, right? So because by its very nature, fractional reserve banking is illiquid. It's not insolvent by its nature. Okay, so Mises defines those terms. To be solvent means that at a given point in time, the market value of the assets of the operation is at least as high as the market value of the liabilities. So in other words, if you sold off all the assets for as much money as you could raise and then paid off all of the creditors, you would be left with something, or at least nothing, but you wouldn't be on the hook still. So that's what it means to be solvent, whereas to be insolvent means even if you sold off all the assets, you couldn't raise enough money to pay off the creditors. To be liquid is a stronger condition. So if you're liquid, you're solvent, but you could be solvent while illiquid. All right? So to be liquid means not only does the market value of your assets exceed the market value of your liabilities, but you actually expect, right now, the cash flow coming available to you because of your assets is enough to satisfy the cash obligations you have to your creditors. So that not only do you have the means to pay them, you can pay them on time. And so Mises is saying, by its very nature, fractional reserve banking is illiquid, because technically what you're doing when you're engaging in fractional reserve banking is people are giving you money, depositors are depositing money with you, and you're saying to them, you have the right, I kind of owe you this money upon demand. So I owe it to you right now, effectively, and then I'm going to go lend it out to somebody else. And so Mises is saying, even if you lend it out in very short-term safe loans, that's still illiquid. You're still not obeying the golden rule. No matter how short-term it is, it's not upon demand, is the point. And even if it were, Mises says that just pushes the problem back one step, because really it couldn't be. Because he's saying, who's going to borrow money from a bank that in principle is immediately callable? The only way they could maintain that is if they didn't, they just kept the cash on hand. And so nobody's going to do that. So Mises' point is, even if you imagine a bank that took in deposits and then lent it out to people and said, by the way, yeah, we're lending you this money, but we have the right to call you up at 9:30 and you better give us that principal back by 9:40 or whatever, by 10 a.m., in practice, that wouldn't make any sense, because what they're going to do with the money is they're going to go invest it somewhere. That's why they're borrowing it from you, is because they want to put it to work. They don't just want to sit on the cash. And so he said, even if you tried to kid yourself that the bank per se were liquid, really it wouldn't be, because in a bank run where it's not just one or two people, but it's a bunch of people who want to get their money, and then the bank calls and all the people that borrowed from it and said, oh, we're calling back those loans, show up here by 10, they couldn't do it because they don't have the money. They're illiquid, and so the system is illiquid. Okay, so I need to stop there. Thank you for tuning in, everybody, and I will, as always, catch up with your questions, if there are any, after the fact, and I'll send out an email talking about the when your quiz is available and the office hours for this week. And stick with us for one more week, because finally we're now in the position where we're going to get into Ludwig von Mises' circulation credit theory of the trade cycle.